June in Indiana is hot, and this day was no different. We, a small group of teenagers fresh from our high school graduation ceremony the night before, stood on the burning asphalt of the parking lot outside our favorite pizza place, saying goodbye. In just a few hours, I would head for the airport with my parents to the house that they had just bought in Colorado, and then that fall, I would be headed off to the University of Southern California. With some of the arrogance, but also the pain of youth, I felt I was too big for the place, that I didn't fit in, and that there was nothing it had to offer me. I couldn't wait to leave Indiana behind. After the others said goodbye that day in the parking lot, one of our party, a young woman named Cindy, grabbed my hand. "Look," she said, her voice filled with urgency, "I know all you've talked about for years was getting out of here." Now, Cindy was right about that, which was no surprise. We'd known each other since sixth grade. She had fiery red hair and keen intelligence that shone out of green eyes. She came from a big, noisy Irish Catholic family, and the stories of her multiple siblings and her trips to the big cathedral across town were like a visit to an exotic country for me. Through 7 years of middle and high school classes, Cindy could always be counted on to bring a thoughtful, intelligent perspective to any conversation. And here she was, holding my hand and speaking earnestly to me. "I made it my mission this year to give you something good to remember," she said. "You helped me so much over the years. I never would have auditioned for all those plays. There are a lot of things I never would have done if you hadn't been here." And then she hugged me and was gone. Afterward, I sat in my car in the parking lot, stunned by Cindy's words. Now, I had always known we were on friendly terms, but I had no idea that she had taken it upon herself to make sure that I had a memorable senior year. But as I thought back on it, I remembered how many of the invitations that had been extended to me had originated with Cindy, how she had often found her way to me in the hallway with a friendly hello, how she'd been there to listen to my chatter through the good times and the bad. And as I sat in my car, my bags packed and ready to go, I realized that if she hadn't said something, I might have flushed the last several years of my life away because I hadn't bothered to notice the good along with the bad. I'd been so focused on the next chapter of my life that I hadn't been experiencing the current chapter as it unfolded. I realized then how much I liked Cindy and a whole host of other people too, and that there was an entire stockpile of good things that had happened, memories now, things I hadn't appreciated in the moment along the way. And like a giant wave is really the only way I can describe it that crashed over me, I felt awash with gratitude. Jon Kabat-Zinn says that mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. Now, Kabat-Zinn should know, mindfulness has become a buzzword in the popular culture recently, and many attribute the Western popularization to Kabat-Zinn. In 1979, to treat the chronically ill, Kabat-Zinn founded the mindfulness-based stress reduction program at the University of Massachusetts. He discovered that through simple mindfulness techniques, the emotional, psychological, even physical health of his patients improved. And his work has inspired similar mindfulness programs now found everywhere, really, schools, prisons, veterans centers, hospitals. So what is it exactly? What is mindfulness? It's really an umbrella term that covers a whole host of techniques and practices. But at their heart, they're centered around this idea of simply paying attention. So at its most basic, mindfulness meditation is practiced by sitting with your eyes closed, kind of like what we did earlier, just for a little bit, but placing attention on the movement of the breath in and out. If you become distracted from your breathing and start to think about other things, which most of us will do, kids, bills, dogs, whatever it is, then you simply return to focusing on your breath. And with regular practice, it becomes easier and easier to keep one's attention focused there and quieting that endless chatter that goes on in most of our minds. You know, that loop of thoughts, a lot of them often negative, that go over and over in the background of our brain. Now, there are infinite variations of this, from nature or labyrinth walk versions to maybe one that's a little less glamorous. Mindful house cleaning is one I was reading about. So, hey, you know, if it works. The point isn't how you do it, it's that you do it. And the point is we should do it. When something finds its way into the popular culture, it can be easy to assume it's a fad. And believe me, I'm the first skeptic out there. But scientific study actually backs up mindfulness practice. I won't exhaust you with the science. Many well-respected studies are available online. But suffice it to say that research on the neural perspective of how mindfulness meditation works shows that it helps us to be more focused in our thoughts, more aware of our bodies, and more emotionally stable. Studies have shown that mindfulness meditation contributes to a more coherent and a healthy sense of well-being, self and identity, helping us to be more authentic, self-accepting, and even compassionate. So in other words, we are kinder to ourselves and to others when we practice mindfulness. But it doesn't stop there, no. Neuroimaging techniques indicate that mindfulness actually changes the network structures in our brain. Harvard Business Review says that recent research provides strong evidence that practicing non-judgmental present moment awareness, aka mindfulness, literally changes the brain. I mean, get that. Doing this practice, simply being mindful, actually changes the structuring in our brain, the way it's wired. And from Harvard University to the University of British Columbia to MIT, the science of mindfulness has been studied and accepted. And this is one of those rare times. This is not what the stance we usually take, but it's one of those rare times when science is sort of catching up to where religious practice has been for centuries. Intuitively, mindfulness is at least 2,500 years old, dating back to Buddhist meditation practices that inspire many contemporary mindfulness techniques. And within the Judeo-Christian tradition, we find the overlapping practices of prayer and contemplation, practices that utilize this idea of close awareness as a means to achieve greater spiritual wholeness. In the Hindu tradition, practices like yogic meditation focus on becoming consciously aware of or investigating into one's own mind and body to know oneself better and more wholly. In Hinduism, like Christianity, there's a focus on a named deity, a divinity, on illuminating the mysteries of the divine through mindfulness practice. So Christian and Hindu mindfulness is about connecting with something higher than oneself, while Buddhist mindfulness is concerned primarily with cultivating full attention to ourselves and the world as it is. So it's no wonder that the Buddhist tradition is really the one that has influenced the popular culture, because it's an understanding of mindfulness that makes room for theists and non-theists alike. Unitarians have dabbled in it too over the years. Transcendentalists like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau popularized ideas gleaned from Asian religions, most notably, again, Buddhism, including concepts that would pave the way for the 20th century West's cultural embrace of mindfulness. And in general, we can't underestimate the impact that the transcendentalists had on American culture. That's a whole other sermon right there. So what is it I'm asking you to take from this today? And what does this have to do with my friend Cindy? Well, first of all, at the very least, what we can take from all this talk about mindfulness is this notion of paying attention. And we can start with our own lives. It's about being in the present moment, truly listening, paying attention to what's happening around us and within us without judgment. And that's really the challenging part. This sounds easy enough in some ways, but as I explained before, I managed to slip through years of high school not really paying attention. I think I thought if I opted out of that whole school experience emotionally, if I were always focused on what's ahead, it would make the tough times easier. The truth is that I missed out on the good things that were happening in the moment. And I think the hard things are easier when they are faced than when they are ignored. I've had far more trouble anticipating the worst than I've had experiencing it. So how do we pay attention? It sounds so basic that it almost seems we shouldn't have to say it, but we do. It's about focusing on the moment, paying attention. Like Rachel was talking about, noticing the colors around you, noticing the smells in the air, noticing how your body feels positioned wherever it is. It's about engaging with life itself. And perhaps that's the reason mindfulness practices have been around for so long. It's a natural response to that deep, basic human yearning for peace and wholeness, a way for us to get in touch with the beauty and the fragility of our lives. And out of this practice of paying attention, something emerges. I will name it as gratitude. Gratitude doesn't happen when we don't pay attention, when we don't notice the Catherine Gallagher's in our midst. Gratitude is the first thing to go when we stop paying attention. We don't hear Judy Hertz and her chime choir. We don't notice it. If we're always looking ahead, we're looking beyond, then how can we feel gratitude for what is around us? And that's what I felt that day after Cindy took my hand and reminded me of what I had been missing, gratitude. I suddenly felt gratitude for all she'd done over that past year to make sure my senior year of high school was something memorable. I suddenly felt gratitude for all the other people who had made me laugh, for even those who had made me cry, who had contributed to my life, who had given me memories to carry with me. What a shame that I hadn't stopped and paid attention along the way, that the gratitude didn't really hit me till the very end, literally the end, bags packed, in the car. Better late than never, though, I guess. And so I have to remind myself often nowadays to be mindful, to pay attention. Life gets busy, and even more than that, there are challenges in our world, in our nation right now that can prompt us to check out and say, oh, I'll be back in 4 years or 8 years or... however long it takes, right? It's easy to feel disheartened, to numb ourselves out of existence, to let all the infinite number of distractions available at the touch of our fingertips on our laptops and our phones carry us away from the moment. But as Unitarian Universalists, if we check out in this way, we would be doing a disservice to ourselves as individuals and our faith tradition as a whole. This week, I attended a CLUE meeting, gathering of clergy and laity concerned about economic justice. We listened to the stories of the workers who had been exploited, ignored, and abused. And I couldn't help but think that on the other side of these workers' concerns are other human beings who have conditioned themselves to ignore these concerns, to be anything but mindful to them. Now, I cannot imagine that someone practicing mindfulness could sit across from someone telling these stories and not want to make a change. And yet, before I get up on my soapbox, we cannot think ourselves above this failing. If we're not mindful, present to the world around us, we could ignore these concerns too. Our Unitarian Universalist principles run the spectrum from the worth and dignity of every person to the interdependent web of all existence. How can we experience and know these things if we aren't paying attention? How can we know each other's value if we are not mindful? How can we see the connection we all have to each other if we're preoccupied with the next chapter of our lives? We have to be here now in the present, breathing in this very moment to know the joys and sorrows of the world we live in. And out of this mindfulness, we can feel gratitude for the gifts and challenges of life itself. And when I do this practice now, I feel overwhelmed with gratitude. I am grateful for this community of seekers, of truth tellers, of justice visioners, for the young and the old and everyone in between who choose to build an inclusive community across differences. I'm grateful for your persistence, for those who have been here for decades, who built the foundation that allows us to be here in this sacred space together. I am grateful for the doers, those of boundless energy who jump in wherever there is need, who get things done. I am grateful for those who sit quietly in the pew, who bring their full presence to this space, offering peace by their very being. I am grateful for those newcomers who find their way to our doors, who brave that step over the threshold, who bring their talents and gifts to their new community. I'm grateful for the losses, for those to whom we say goodbye, for Walt Dobley and Sophia Alper and Jack Thiebert and all those community members who leave us and in so doing remind us how precious we are to each other. I'm grateful for the forgiveness we show to one another, for the recognition we have each and every day that we are imperfect, I am imperfect, that sooner or later we will disappoint each other, and that's okay. That's part of being in relationship. I'm grateful for this faith, this hard-to-explain faith of Unitarian Universalism, built out of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but now something more that we are only beginning to name and explain as we pioneer it into a new century. And that is what we're doing, folks, pioneering this into a new century of personal and societal transformation. And I am grateful for each and every one of you. And I'm grateful that I learned to take a breath along the way. A couple of years ago, I found my old friend Cindy online. Now, I hadn't seen her in roughly 20 years. I wrote to her, and this is what she wrote back to me, exact wording. Sometimes I use poetic license. This is it, exactly as she wrote it. I'm so happy to hear from you, and I'm delighted you are now a minister. I was married briefly while living in Chicago, and during my divorce, I attended a Unitarian church in Oak Park, Illinois. It was really the right support at the right time for me. A very welcoming community who helped me figure out my call in life. I'm now a licensed marriage and family therapist. I love the connection with people. Honestly can say that I'm thrilled with what I'm doing. So happy you reached out. So the lesson for me is that noticing matters. We need to notice the world around us, the people in our lives, the things we are grateful for. And when we do that, we are better positioned to do the work of Unitarian Universalism, to help ourselves and others find a place in this world that gives space for all of us to live out our full potential as human beings. Whether it's my old friend Cindy becoming a therapist or someone in the community finding their capacity to do something they hadn't thought was possible for them. We can be the dream makers, the flame carriers, the singers of songs that move humanity toward its best. Let us stop, breathe, and be. May it be so.